Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, PepsiCo says it's closing their snacks plant here in Liberty, New York, resulting in the loss of nearly 300 jobs. We talk to local leaders about the impact on the community. The Trump administration tries to red light NYC's congestion pricing project. Governor Hochul plans to fight it. And the Natural Resources Defense Council says there is no legal or factual basis to simply slam the brakes on this program. We'll get reaction. Plus, Native American portage routes, the interconnected routes once used by the Algonquin people on waterways including Rondout Creek, Neversink River, Calicoon Creek, and the Delaware River. A self-guided maple tour coming up, and we'll meet singer-songwriter Jenna Nichols. All coming up, first the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The government entity called DOGE is claiming that it has saved taxpayers billions of dollars. This week, the Trump administration launched a website that tracks these savings. NPR Stephen Fowler says the claimed savings are not as rosy as DOGE says they are.
The claims weren't off by just a little bit, but rather overstated by billions. Half of these savings claimed in these receipts comes from what DOGE said was actually a typo entered into the federal contract database a few years ago that made a listing worth up to $8 million look like $8 billion. That typo was fixed in the system a few weeks ago, but only fixed on the DOGE website yesterday.
NPR Stephen Fowler reporting. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke by phone today with several European leaders. NPR's Polina Litvinova reports the leaders have held a second meeting in Paris.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was among those who assured Ukraine of their support. He published a video on X saying Canada will always stand up for Ukraine.
Canada and our allies are unequivocal on standing up against Vladimir Putin's illegal, immoral, unjust violations of the international order.
After President Trump criticized Ukraine's leader for not holding elections during the war and called him a dictator, some European leaders spoke up in support of Zelensky. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said it was dangerous to deny Zelensky's legitimacy. The Ukrainian constitution prohibits elections during martial law, which was announced in 2022 after Russia invaded Ukraine. Polina Litvinova, NPR News, Kyiv.
Israel has received the bodies of four Israeli hostages held in captivity in Gaza. They included a young mother and her two children. The fourth body was that of an older man. Hamas is scheduled to release six living hostages on Saturday. In exchange, Israel is to free about 600 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Stocks opened sharply lower this morning after a cautious sales forecast from Walmart. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrials fell about 400 points in early trading.
Walmart reported strong sales and profits for its most recent quarter, but the retail giant is warning of a possible slowdown in the months to come as cautious shoppers keep a tight grip on their wallets, and President Trump's tariff moves threaten to put upward pressure on prices. New applications for unemployment benefits showed little change last week. Widespread job cuts in the federal government have yet to show up in the data. Republican Congressman Don Bacon is urging the government to be more thoughtful about those job cuts after the Agriculture Department mistakenly fired workers who were fighting the bird flu outbreak. Cuts the department is now trying to reverse, Humpty Dumpty style. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Temperatures are still frigid in much of the central U.S. this morning. In Bismarck, North Dakota, it's 22 degrees below zero. With the wind chill, it feels like more than 40 degrees below zero. It's been really cold for days in the plains, and the National Weather Service says that widespread record cold will continue through tomorrow. Weather forecasters say that a warming trend will arrive by the weekend. Philadelphia is saying goodbye to the SS United States. It has been docked in the city for nearly 30 years. Now, the historic ocean liner is starting its final voyage. From member station WHYY, Matt Gillum reports the vessel is poised to set one more record.
The nearly 1,000-foot-long SS United States is finally on its way to begin its transformation into the biggest artificial reef in the world. The now rusting but stately ocean liner set the transatlantic speed record in both directions on its 1952 maiden voyage, a record it still holds. The rise of the jet age proved the ship's downfall, and it left active service in 1969. Dubbed America's flagship, the SS United States is bound for Alabama, where it'll be cleaned and prepared for its final resting place, on the seafloor in the warm waters off the Florida Panhandle. For NPR News, I'm Matt Gillum in Philadelphia.
Former Democratic U.S. Senator from Oklahoma and Governor David Boren has died at the age of 83, according to his family. He'd had a long illness. Boren served several terms in the Oklahoma State House before becoming a U.S. Senator. After leaving Congress, Boren was president of Oklahoma's largest public university, retiring in 2018. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. PepsiCo has announced the closure of its manufacturing facility in the Village of Liberty, New York, where it produces Popcorners brand snacks. The closure will result in the loss of approximately 300 jobs, significantly impacting local workers and businesses. Patricia Rubio reports.
PepsiCo has announced the closure of its manufacturing facility in the Village of Liberty, a plant that produces the popular Popcorners snack. This facility, formerly known as Ideal Snacks since the late 90s, until PepsiCo acquired the brand around 2018, and the facility employed approximately 300 workers. The facility has been a fixture in Liberty for years, employing a substantial portion of the local workforce. Sullivan County Legislator for District 6, Louis Alvarez, expressed deep concern about the impact of the closure, particularly on the close-knit Hispanic community in Liberty.
It's a large group of people that live here in Sullivan County, especially they live in Liberty. I recognize most of them from church. I see them. They live here. Their family goes to school here, and they invest in this county. They buy food here, they eat here, they purchase houses. These are local people that live here. And I'm looking at this, I'm just trying to figure out, it would really affect us very badly, especially because most of them have made their life here. This is their home. This is where their kids are being raised this time. I feel this is going to really impact us really hard.
Alvarez talks about the strong connection between the plant's employees and the Village of Liberty, highlighting Hispanics' contributions to the community.
When I moved to the Village of Liberty, there was actually no Hispanics in my street. And today, at least, I will say that most like 8 or 9 of the houses there are owned by Hispanics. I can hear them playing football, or soccer, if you want to call it that way, in the backyard of my house because it backs up the Liberty Center School District, and I can hear them. So they are here. They're here to stay. They're here to be part of our community. They participate in our community. Like I said, I see them in church all the time. I've made a lot of friends there. They work really hard. They're not persons who just sit around. They're always willing to do something. Now, look at all the activities that have happened in the last years in the Village of Liberty alone, with the Hispanic community celebrating like the 5th of May and other activities. You can see that there's a very large community, and they're very family-oriented. They really want to participate in all the activities and be part of our community. And they have become part of our community.
The closure not only threatens the livelihoods of the plant workers, but also casts a shadow over the local economy. Alvarez spoke about the potential ripple effect on local businesses.
I can say clearly that if you walk down the streets, Main Street of the Village of Liberty, you'll realize they have changed the community because they're always there and they use their regular restaurants and everything that's in that facility and then in that area.
PepsiCo has released a statement to Radio Catskill citing the challenges of sustaining the Liberty's plant's long-term viability due to the growth pace of Popcorners. The company stated, and I quote, "We deeply appreciate the contributions of our Liberty employees, and this decision does not diminish the value of their hard work and dedication. We have notified our workforce and are working closely with our employees and local community officials to provide a supportive transition." Local officials, including the Liberty Village Mayor Joan Stoddard and the county legislature, We'll be discussing possible steps to mitigate the impact of this closure. Alvarez says these discussions will be ongoing.
Well, we talked among the legislators, and we're going to talk about it tomorrow when we have the meetings to see what we have to do, and we're going to try to reach as far as we can to see what can we do and how can we do this. I've spoken to the mayor of the Village of Liberty, John Stoddard, about it because it will hit the village really hard.
For now, uncertainty looms over the workers and their families as they await further details from PepsiCo and local officials. In Liberty, I'm Patricio Arroyo for Radio Catskill.
And the Sullivan County Legislature is meeting this morning. Sullivan County Legislature Chair Nadia Reich, Town of Liberty Supervisor Frank DeMeo, and Village of Liberty Mayor Joan Stoddard jointly issued the following statement yesterday on the closure, saying, quote, "We are deeply concerned about PepsiCo's decision to shutter their Liberty food manufacturing facility, which has been an integral part of our community for decades and employs hundreds of locals. This action will have many impacts, which we intend to sort out with PepsiCo's assistance in the coming weeks. Sullivan County, the Town of Liberty, the Village of Liberty, and partners like the Chamber of Commerce and Partnership for Economic Development will be assisting the impacted workers in every way we can, including by providing needed services to individuals and families and offering the full support of our Center for Workforce Development in keeping our residents locally employed. While this news appears devastating at this time, all of us as a united community will work hard to meet this challenge and provide a better future," end quote. We'll have an update tomorrow from Dan Hoost, Sullivan County Government's Communications Director, for his regular appearance. Now, the Trump administration tries to slam the brakes on New York City's congestion pricing project. The Metropolitan Transportation Authority quickly filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration Wednesday after the U.S. Transportation Secretary said it would reverse federal approval for the MTA's congestion pricing program. Standing alongside MTA leaders in Manhattan Wednesday, Governor Kathy Hochul defended the pricing plan implemented last month. It charges most drivers $9 to enter Lower Manhattan. Governor Hochul said the lawsuit is about New York's sovereignty.
"I don't care if you love congestion pricing or hate it. This is an attack on our sovereign identity, our independence from Washington. And this is... We are a nation of states. This is what we fought for. This is what people like Alexander Hamilton and others fought for, to set up a system where we are not subservient to a king or anyone else out of Washington."
Joining us now with more reaction is Eric A. Goldstein, senior attorney at NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, which has advocated for congestion pricing for more than a decade. Eric, good morning.
Morning, Tim.
What was your initial reaction to the Trump administration's decision to reverse its support for New York City's congestion pricing program yesterday?
Well, while it wasn't completely unexpected, it is disappointing that after 4 years of study, 4,000 pages of analysis, and 6 weeks in which congestion pricing has demonstrated that it's working for all New Yorkers, that the Trump administration has once again made an effort to upend this sensible strategy.
How has congestion pricing been effective so far in reducing traffic congestion and improving mobility in Manhattan?
Well, perhaps surprisingly to some people, traffic speeds are actually up. The preliminary data show traffic jams are down. Express buses and commuters who feel they must drive into the Manhattan Central Business District, they're getting there faster and saving time. And businesses seem to be doing pretty well, too. Restaurant reservations are up 7%. Broadway ticket sales are up 25%. And, of course, the program is generating funds to make the region's subway, bus, and commuter rail system one that is reliable and efficient for everyone throughout the tri-state region.
The Trump administration argues that the decision from the Transportation Department is necessary to address what they say are concerns over fairness and the impact on residents. What's your response to those claims?
Well, contrary to what the Federal Department of Transportation says, the working class Americans will benefit and are benefiting from congestion pricing. Keep in mind that 9 out of 10 commuters who come into the Central Business District on a regular basis come by public transportation. And they are going to benefit because they will, for the first time in years, have subway enhancements, new buses, and a whole variety of benefits for the commuter rail system. But drivers will benefit, too, from these faster speeds and from saving time. The partnership, which is a leading business organization, predicts that savings in the billions of dollars a year will result because deliveries can be made more swiftly. Workers will save time in their commutes. And there's a real price to the kind of incessant stop-and-go traffic congestion that makes it so hard for folks to move around the region and the Central Business District. And this strategy is aimed at tackling those problems.
You know, there are a lot of people who don't like congestion pricing, specifically folks, you know, in the suburbs outside Manhattan, people here upstate that travel into the city. So is this this action by the U.S. Department of Transportation a significant legal challenge for their concerns? And what do you think the chances are that they will prevail? What do we know about the future here?
Well, again, somewhat surprisingly, commuters from across the region who find that they are saving 15, 20, and 30 minutes in their daily driving commutes into the city are surprised that the program seems to be working, and at least they're getting some benefit from the tolling program. And if you're taking an express bus, your trips are a lot faster as well, and people are scooting in and out of the city. So there are benefits for everyone. And of course, Manhattan is the economic engine for the entire region, and making sure that mobility can be enhanced for everyone who goes into and out of Manhattan benefits everyone, upstate, downstate, and across the region. In turning to the merits of the case, you know, you can never predict what a court will do, but the state and the MTA appear to have a strong case. There is no authority, as they argue in their court papers that they filed yesterday, no authority in statute or in the Constitution that gives the federal government the unilateral authority to terminate the congestion pricing program to which they previously agreed.
So the legal burden is on the Department of Transportation to reverse their position.
That's absolutely right. Federal agencies, they made a formal decision and signed an agreement to advance the program, and they just can't change their minds. In other cases, courts have set a high bar when agencies in the federal government seek to do a 180-degree turnabout, and a simple change of administrations hasn't been proven to be a legally sufficient justification that would uphold such a reversal.
You heard that clip of Governor Kathy Hochul from yesterday. She was pretty fired up. What role do you see the NRDC playing in responding to this reversal and ensuring that congestion pricing remains a key part of the traffic and environmental strategy for the city and the state?
Well, there have been other previous legal challenges to this program, and NRDC has been one of the group of lawyers representing a diverse group of transportation people, business people, environmental groups, civic associations, all supporting the state and the MTA in this program. And I expect we will probably come in and file a supporting brief in the case which the MTA and New York State have brought.
And we mentioned the legal burden on the Federal Transportation Department. Could the government threaten to withhold funding for other New York programs and projects until they apparently get what they want?
It's conceivably possible that Congress or the federal government could look for other methods to try to coerce New York State into switching off this program, but the status quo holds for now, and significantly, the federal government has not asked for an immediate shutdown in their letter to the governor yesterday. So we're confident that at least for now, this program is going to continue and provide benefits not only for transit riders, But for everyone who commutes into the New York area and for the region as a whole.
So as you mentioned, congestion pricing not dead. It lives on for now. So if you're traveling down into the city, you will pay for most passenger cars $9 to enter that designated tolling zone between below 60th Street in Manhattan. So now that these lawsuits have been filed, the threats of seeing you in court, how long do we think this process will take?
Well, it's hard to make predictions, as Yogi Berra said, especially about the future. But it's likely to unfold in the weeks ahead. But the news for now is that the program is continuing, and New Yorkers, whether they commute by public transit or by automobile, will be getting the benefits of congestion pricing. Much like folks in London, Stockholm, and Singapore have seen the benefits of this strategy working in their cities for years.
And if there are folks who are seeing those benefits and they want to advocate for the continuation of this program and ensure it continues long term, are there steps that they can take?
Well, one thing they can do is let the governor know that she's standing up for all New Yorkers in working on this program. And they can let their representatives in Congress know that they think that this program is in the best overall long-term interests for both city and suburbs.
We've been talking to Eric A. Goldstein, senior attorney at NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council, about the threat from the U.S. Transportation Secretary saying it would reverse federal approval for the MTA's congestion pricing program in Manhattan. The MTA quickly filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration Wednesday. There's more information about NRDC at nrdc.org. Eric, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Native American portage routes, those are interconnected routes once used by the Algonquin people on waterways locally, including the Calicoon Creek, Neversink River, and the Delaware River. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, we're going back to the archives with a 2014 conversation with Nigerian writer Chimamanda Adichie, recorded around the time of her breakthrough novel, Americana. Adichie has a new book, and she'll be back for another appearance in March. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On Sunday, author and historian Evan Pritchard will be hosting a virtual presentation delving into the history of the Native American portage routes across New York. The event, titled By Any Means Necessary, Retracing Algonquin Portage Routes in New York, will be online. And Evan Pritchard joins us now to tell us more. Evan, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Tim.
Can you tell us more about the significance of these Algonquin portage routes that you're going to be discussing? What role did these routes play in the daily lives of Native Americans in the area? And also, can you just define what a portage route is for folks, too?
Right. So a portage route is basically where you go from the end of one creek to the beginning of another creek. And so you have to carry your boat. And the original lightweight birch bark canoes were designed for this, and two people, you know, could do it or more, sometimes one. But what that does is it greatly extends your range of travel by, I don't know, a factor of a million almost, because it's almost infinite. But just immediately you could go, you know, across a ridge at the edge of a watershed and go into another watershed or water system and then travel to all these different places that you couldn't otherwise. So I'm calling it by any means necessary, because to us, to some people today, it might seem like a lot of trouble, but it was well worth it for them. And they would go get to where they're going by any means necessary, which means carrying their boat.
You, in fact,
the beginning of it.
You, in fact, are a descendant of the Mi'kmaq people, a founder of the Center for Algonquin Culture, and you've dedicated much of your career to preserving and sharing this history of Native American communities. How did you come to trace these specific portage routes, such as those along the ones I kind of mentioned earlier, Rondout Creek, Delaware River, and others?
Well, it was kind of one of the later discoveries. I mean, people, there's just a few books written about portages. Keys to the Continent is an old book talking about this phenomenon. But then I just was, I guess, looking at some of these maps, because I do a lot of mapping, and I publish a lot of maps of Algonquin territories as they were, and I noticed that, you know, this explains a lot when you understand they really did it. They really would go from one system to another carrying their canoes. I don't remember, I guess, what the very first one I discovered was. I didn't think about that. But there's lots of them. And they explain why our roads are where they are.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Like, today's Route 55 is a remnant of ancient Native American portage routes, right?
Right. Right. So it goes through, that's one of the ones I'm going to focus on, of course, at Grantsville, because that goes right through there. That's one of the more exciting ones, more obvious too. You're looking at a map even, you know, today, and you can see, you know, the Neversink River connecting several ways to the Esopus through, you know, over by, you know, Winnisook, which is that high camp, which means snow to, you know, Winnisook means lovely form of precipitation. So you can connect there with you know, with the Neversink, and that goes down to towards Grantsville, where you take out your canoe at you know, you have two creeks. You have Red Creek, and then you have you know, Chestnut. And so 55 actually is the route, you know, approximate route or travel corridor, which can take you along that into, you know, going further through Grantsville and then into the, you know, Neversink and other water rooms. Also, Willow and Weemock Creek is very important, and that's a short portage from there. And then you go down the Neversink, and you can, there's a short portage to the Mongat Valley system, a whole system of rivers. And then, unfortunately, it's a bit of a hike from the Mongat over to where you are in Jeffersonville, but it's, you know, they could do it along 52, which is a remnant of an old trail. And that gets you into the Callicoon system. And the Callicoon system I'm going to talk about, because it's almost like it's like a clamshell valley where the point of it is right on the Delaware. And so you get any of those branches of the Callicoon, they all lead to the village called Callicoon.
Oh, so explain again, clamshell valley. What is that again?
Well, it's a valley that, you know, was outlined by these various branches of the Callicoon Creek, and they all meet at one point near the Delaware River, and it's a valley that just happens to have a shape similar to an inverted clamshell. You know, it's fairly round. It's a valley, but it's round.
And there's also a connection between routes, Route 23 and some routes west, Route 28. Can you talk about the importance of those routes in the region's history as well?
I guess 28 was one of the first ones I really investigated very closely, because, you know, there was some dispute. And I actually gave workshops, you know, taking people along. We didn't actually canoe, as it turned out. We went by car, and we traced 28, which is very interesting. Give me a second here. That one that, you know, that's probably one of my favorites, really. But 28 connects, of course, it goes along the Esopus for quite a ways. And then once beyond that, you go to High Mount, which is actually a portage. High Mount goes over from, Ulster County over into the Delaware Valley. And once you go past that one, you're following 28, and it follows a lot of very small creeks, one after another, from connecting the end of one, the beginning of another. And I had a list here, and it's going to find it.
That's okay.
But anyway, so 28, I have a map that I published of 28 going all the way to Oneonta. So it's a long way, and it's a lot of picking up and putting down. Oh, here it is. My route 28 goes into the Delaware Valley to Birch Creek, Emery Creek, East Branch, Delaware, Dry Brush, Platte, Bryant, the Little Delaware, which is a very important crossing, Falls Creek, Ulladit, and then the Susquehanna near Oneonta. That's all 28 follows all those creeks and connects. So that was part of that portage route. And then they kind of made it all one route. What was the other one? 23.
Yeah, 23 through Stanford.
That's one of my favorites. I mean, I've studied that with, Michael Kudish and I worked on that one. He is a great naturalist and historian. And, we went up there and we went to Usianta Mountain, where you can see three or four different portages from there in the different creeks. And, so that's very dramatic. And what happened was there was a conflict of sorts, nothing major, I guess, but with the Delaware people, the Muncie and the Mohawk both needed that same crossing that's over by Usianta, which connects the Bear River with some of the ones that goes west. And so they brought the Shawnee in by treaty to come all the way up from Alabama to, watch over that from Usianta. And, so that route, was very significant. And in, so 23 turns out to be that route, or 100 feet from it, actually. Yeah. And that goes to Oneonta also.
You've written a few books, Native New Yorkers, The Legacy of the Algonquin People of New York, No Word for Time, The Way of the Algonquin People. You've taught about Native American history. How important is it to continue educating people about the Native American history and culture in our region?
Great question. That ties in with the whole land acknowledgement movement, which actually I helped to start, because when I was doing ceremonies 40 years ago, the native people would say, well, if you do something, you have to mention who was there on that land, because in our territory, a lot of times they're not still here. So I feel it's very important in terms of identity. I think people need to be clear about their identity, and our identities as individuals involve, what our father and mother, the ancestry, but also where we stand. And if we don't know who was there, then we don't know our local identity. So if you're taking any town in the region, Washingtonville, Liberty, the part of the identity of that place should be derived from who was there and who created that, the subculture that grew out of that. So in terms of one's own identity, you should need to know whose land you're standing on, because it matters. I think these things still carry through.
Has your identity and your heritage influenced your passion for researching and sharing Native American history?
Absolutely. That's where a lot of it comes from. I wanted to understand who I was, not only as a, what country I, vote in or in what economic system I have now, but what more importantly is my cultural heritage and how that's influenced my thinking. And I find that I agree with the Mi'kmaq beliefs and customs very much, and it shouldn't be surprising.
This
I write about it.
Yeah, this event is coming up on Sunday at 2. It's put on by the Time and Valleys Museum. time and the Valley's Museum. There is a registration link because it's virtual. It's free for museum members, $5 for non-members. The information there is timeandthevalleysmuseum.org. Evan, before we go, anything else you want to let folks know about the presentation, but also just this understanding of this one particular thing? And you know, I would not have known about, you know, Route 55 being this old portage route that the Native Americans used if we weren't talking today.
Yeah, 55 connects many of these portage areas, and Grahamsville is a hub for portage routes. Almost all of these local rivers can easily be connected to Grahamsville because it's in this, you know, portage, important portage in the hub. So you have, the Sopus is accessible through Mamindasi, which is the Panther Mountain. It means panther. And through the Neversink and through, all the ones I've mentioned have a connection to Grahamsville. So I've always had that, on my mind. I had my eye on Grahamsville all along. And so it's been a long journey. But I did a map of those portages on Route 28 and ended up in the museum in Queens. The Queens Museum posted that on their walls. Their physical walls, by the way, for a year. You know, so that was fun.
Yeah.
I have a lot of maps of Algonquin settlements. But let me just say, if I have one more 30 seconds.
Yeah.
If people doubt, you know, that these, why would they go through all the trouble? There was a 60-mile-long Mohawk trade route going from the Schoharie through the Neversink all the way down by Jeffersonville and Liberty, all the way to the Delaware River. And they called that place the trading place of the Mohawk. And it is well documented. And where did the Mohawks come from on the Delaware River and Port Jervis? Well, they came all the way to 60 miles through all these backwaters, back routes, because, you know, when you want to trade those beaver skins, you know, you go by any means necessary. And that was the only option for them. So all the others seem tame by comparison.
Wow.
So this is a real thing. And people still do it more in the West now, and very few people do it around here, but they used to. So that's what I wanted to add on here, is that we have, you know, definite proof. A lot of this hasn't been well documented, so I'm hoping that my talk here will lead to further research.
Well, fascinating to understand how interconnected it all was and still is in some ways. That is author and historian Evan Pritchard. His virtual presentation, By Any Means Necessary, Retracing Algonquin Portage Routes in New York, is Sunday at 2. You can get that link from timeandthevalleysmuseum.org. Evan, thank you so much for joining us and shedding some light on this, and looking forward to your talk. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. See you there. Bye-bye.
We'll take a break, and we'll learn more about another route. This one, maple syrup in northeast Pennsylvania. This is Radio Chatskill.
When she teaches her students how to write a song, musician Scarlett Keys says they need to ask themselves certain questions.
What is the thing that keeps you up at night? What's the thing you can't stop thinking about? As songwriters, we are repurposing human tropes and a new viewpoint with new words, with new music.
The people and technology behind the soundtracks of our lives. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's a live event with the close-knit food scene of Indianapolis. From a pioneering prosecutor-turned-restaurateur to a pair of young protégés carrying on the legacy of a beloved baker, we're talking the past, present, and future of the indie food world. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11, on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, maple syrup has a very long history in our area, dating back to the Native American tribes who first discovered how to turn sap into syrup and sugar. In the heart of northeast Pennsylvania, the time-honored tradition continues to thrive, and visitors can get a first-hand look at the process during the annual self-guided maple tour hosted by the Northeastern Pennsylvania Maple Producers Association. Here to tell us a little bit more about that is Trevor Tuchidlowski from the Wayne Conservation District. Trevor, good morning.
Morning to you, too. You nailed my last name.
I didn't quite stick the landing, but close enough. Thank you. You know, we talked about how there's this rich history of maple syrup production. Can you talk a little bit more about the significance in our region?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, first and foremost, you were exactly right with what you said. I mean, it was the Native Americans that that basically discovered that, you know, that the sap of sugar maples can be turned into syrup. It's something that's been going on for a very long time at this point. And aside from the, you know, the people aspect of it, it's something that's pretty unique to our area, just for a multitude of reasons. It's interesting because it's not only a process that specifically pertains to sugar maples, but the process itself is environmentally driven. So not only is it a species thing, but it's also a regional thing on top of that. So obviously, like, we have a few different states along the East Coast that are capable of producing syrup, but a lot more have sugar maples collectively. But it's this region in particular that allows us to actually take advantage of the sap that they produce.
Now, I mentioned the self-guided maple tour. That's coming up March 1st and 2nd next weekend. It's a big event. Tell us more about what that means, a self-guided maple tour, and what visitors can expect from that experience.
Yeah, so the self-guided maple tour that's been going on for quite a bit of time at this point, several decades. The thing is, it's gone through a few different iterations over the years. But as of lately, we've settled on the self-guided aspect of it just because we have a lot of different sugar house locations. At this point, we have about 15 locations that are sugar houses specifically, with two more offering pancake breakfasts. And the neat thing about it is that every single location is going to be pretty different. And they're spread all over, of course, as the organization name suggests, Northeast Pennsylvania, ranging anywhere from people that have only a few hundred taps to people that have well over 10,000. So you get a pretty different perspective on kind of like homegrown operations versus those that are a little bit more on the industrial side of things. So it's a very, very neat tour. You learn a lot.
You answered one of my questions, will there be pancakes? So yes, good.
definitely pancakes.
How does this maple tour help educate people about this history and the environmental importance of maple syrup production as well?
Well, I would make the argument that the producers themselves are going to be your best source of information. Some of these people are multi-generational. They've been doing this for a very long time. And the neat thing about it is, too, and I kind of touched on this a little bit before briefly, is that you're getting different scales involved in each of these operations. So what I mean by that is you're going to get some folks that are going to be doing more traditional means, which is going to involve, you know, a wood-fired evaporator, and they're going to go through and do the process in a little bit more of a traditional sense. Not so many people use buckets anymore. Sometimes they will set out more so displays for that purpose. But then you get the other side of it where even though people are ultimately doing the same exact thing, which is, you know, reducing raw sap down to the syrup, a higher sugar content, they'll be using more modern practices like reverse osmosis and pump-driven sap lines and things of that nature. So, you know, having an opportunity to go out and talk to different people, you're really going to get a wide scope of information about the process and how it was done historically and how it's kind of done in a modern sense.
Yeah, and in the modern sense, are there practices being implemented to ensure the health of the sugar bushes?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that's one of the biggest concerns. I mean, I would make the argument that there's more, the greatest concern is more so environmental stressors. You can definitely overcap a tree, but the process of harvesting sap from the sugar maple itself isn't really a harmful process. Again, unless you're taking advantage of a tree that's not a suitable diameter and you're drilling too many holes in it. That's when it can become a problem. But at this point in time, I mean, everyone's pretty well versed in sustainable practice. I mean, that's the key part of this industry as a whole is, and I would argue most forestry concepts is that it should be sustainable. So the folks that are, you know, they're actually going through the process of producing syrup, they want to ensure the health of their sugar bush, not only for, monetary reasons, but also just, of course, for health reasons. And fortunately, those two things overlap. So the practices that they implement, again, you know, making sure that the diameter of the tree is taken into place, the amount of holes that are tapped into the tree to begin with, all of those lend toward a much more sustainable environment for syrup production.
There are, more than 15 local maple producers participating in the self-guided maple tour March 1st through 2nd. Is that number, growing? Or do you see the industry growing in the area?
Yeah. So the neat thing is that we're always getting new members in the association. But the nice thing about this is that it's a pretty low pressure event for the Sugar House, participants. So, every single year, we get a few folks that are, I'll refer to them as repeat customers, that are pretty consistent tour locations. But then every so often, we get a new group that wants to join on that, you know, might have been making maple syrup for a little while now, and they're interested in participating. Other times, we get people that have been doing it for a very long time but weren't familiar with the tour. So that's kind of a secondary objective of advertising for this, is to get new producers involved. It's definitely growing, and from my time at the Conservation District, every single year we've seen a slight uptick in the amount of participants. So it's definitely expanding.
You are the forest specialist for Wayne Conservation District, obviously passionate about the forest conservation. Do you have a particular personal connection to maple syrup, or a memorable maple memory?
Yeah, definitely. I would say one of my first exposures to the non-timber forest product industry was I graduated from Keystone College, and up there we have our sugar shack, where I actually did a brief internship there, as well as I did a lot of trail maintenance. So it was very frequent that I was up there feeding the fire and cleaning up the lines, drilling trees, putting in the taps. So I'm very, very familiar. And it's something that I really look forward to each year. And then on top of that, I just built a home in the middle of a sugar bush. So I'm hoping that, once I get a little bit more free time, I'll be able to take advantage of the sugar maples that surround me.
You have settled in the middle of it. Great. Tell folks where they can get more information about the upcoming self-guided maple tour.
Yeah, so we switched over to a digital flyer format. You might be able to see some floating around in Honesdale and other locations. But if you want to go to wayneconservation.com, under the forestry tab, you'll see a link that goes directly to our digital flyer. We keep this updated. You know, if there's ever an instant where someone needs to drop out of the tour or someone wants to come on, it makes it very easy for us to keep information updated and to make sure that all the information's current. And then on top of that, if you ever wanted to just give me a call and have a chat with me about it, you could call 570-253-0930 and just ask for me, Trevor. And lastly, we have the number of our president, which is 570-493-1229, and he should be available pretty much any day of the week.
That's Trevor Tuchodlowski. We've been talking about the upcoming self-guided maple tour, March 1st through 2nd, and yes, there will be pancakes. More information at the Wayne Conservation District's website. Trevor, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk to Jenna Nichols, a modern folk music singer-songwriter. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Mimi Bradley, Radio Catskills Development Manager, reminding you that a great way to keep public radio here in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania is by becoming a Sound Supporter. Sound Supporters give small amounts, $20, $30, $50 a month or more, that add up to a big help. Plus, Sound Supporters get special thank yous, like drawings for tickets to events in our community throughout the year. Become a Sound Supporter. Go to wjffradio.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In the world of modern folk music, few artists blend genres with the same grace and authenticity as Jenna Nichols. With three albums under her belt, this singer-songwriter has woven a unique tapestry of sound, seamlessly fusing the rich soulful spirit of New Orleans with the rugged charm of the American West. She's playing tonight at The Colony in Woodstock, New York, along with Kate Prasher, whom we spoke with yesterday, and Jenna Nichols joins us now. Good morning, Jenna.
Hi, how are you?
Oh,
thanks
good.
For having me.
Thanks for being here. Now, would you describe your sound the way I did, that mix of a soulful New Orleans sound to some of the nostalgic American West sound?
Yes, absolutely. Spot on.
Okay, good. My work here is done. so you've established yourself, as I said, as this unique voice. Can you share the inspiration behind that music and your latest album, how it reflects your growth as an artist, too?
Sure. So I have always had a love of old-time music, the American songbook, songs from the 30s, cowboy songs, early jazz, and that's really how I learned to play, was by listening to all of those types of music. And so, you know, when you learn from listening rather than taking lessons, it just is kind of reflected in your own style. So that's kind of how that came about. I also loved listening to and watching old movies, you know, Fred and Ginger movies, and all of the composers in those movies were, you know, Irving Berlin and George Gershwin, greats like that. They were basically just writing songs for the day, and they eventually became the classics that we know today. So with all of that, you know, taking in all of that music, that's kind of how my style developed.
And how do you evolve that style, that sort of a vintage feel you're talking about, and evolve it as you move forward and, you know, create new sounds for future?
That's a good question. I really don't know how it's going to evolve. I just sort of write what comes out at the time, and I don't question it. So, you know, I think an artist, any artist's evolution is, they don't know when it's, where it's going to lead them. And that's what's fun about it. So, you know, I just try and listen to everything that I can. And, just, there are certain things that I'll latch onto. And in the moment they come out in certain ways, and that's just, I'm going with it.
You also like to experiment with instruments in your compositions too, right?
Talk
about some of those instruments, particularly the ukulele.
Yeah. So, I went and heard a show. It's a really bizarre story. I went to hear a show, that Eddie Vedder was doing on the ukulele, and he played the whole show on the ukulele, and it was really great. And I said, I have a ukulele sitting in the corner of my room that I've never touched. And so, I started to learn how to play it. And, then all of a sudden these sort of old timey sounds started being written by me. And I just kind of rolled with it. But most of the time when I pick up an instrument, that instrument will dictate the kind of sound that will develop in the song, you know. So the ukulele tends to have a little bit more of a old time jazz sound. The piano has a little bit more of a later style Americana. And then the guitar is more of like has a little bit of a country vibe to it.
You mentioned those inspirations, and you mentioned, you know, those movies, those older movies. How do you weave in some of your personal experiences in addition to these, like, sort of more fictional narratives into your songwriting and music?
So those things just kind of happen in the writing process. You know, there are things that will happen in my everyday that I will sort of, They'll come out when I least expect them. And when I'm writing, I'll just pull on an experience that I've had. I don't really go into it with a plan to write about a specific thing, but once I can latch on to a certain idea, then it's my job to make sure that idea stays true through the entire song, and I kind of don't meander too far off point. But I do try and create visuals in my writing, and for that, I pull on everyday experiences that I've had, just because those are the life moments that I've had that I can draw on.
You're performing tonight, actually, at the the Colony in Woodstock with Kate Prasher, who we spoke to yesterday. Have you shared the stage with Kate before, or what are you looking forward to in tonight's performance?
I have not shared the stage with her before, and I'm very excited. She's a wonderful singer and a wonderful performer. She has a beautiful, beautiful voice, and I love her writing as well. So we've been in the same venue at the same time, and we've met at shows, and we've talked, but this is the first night that we're going to actually share the stage together, so I'm really excited for that.
And that's tonight at the Colony in Woodstock. There's more information at colonywoodstock.com. More information about Jenna at jennanichols.com. Two L's there in Nichols. Before we go, Jenna, I just want to leave folks with a little bit of your music. How about we play Sunday Drivers?
That's great.
All right. Jenna Nichols, thank you so much for joining us, and have a great show tonight.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
We are Sunday drivers on a winding road. We don't know where we're going, and the sun's on the horizon. You're at my right, picking songs on the radio. I love you till the end of the line. There's no better way to pass the time. Let the clocks all unwind, set ourselves free on a Sunday drive.
That's Jenna Nichols. She's performing with Kate Prasher tonight at the Colony in Woodstock at 7. More information at colonywoodstock.com. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
I've never wondered too far from home, spent so many days alone. Now we're driving round little quiet towns. I've paid no mind to when I was on my own. To the end of the line, drive on forever, I don't mind. Let the cars pass us by, we're taking it easy on a
Radio Catskill supporters include Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, SullivanCatskills.com. Catskill Brewery, brewing ales, lagers, and mixed fermentation beers in a LEED Gold certified building, plus a food truck and beer garden at exit 96 off Route 17 in Livingston Manor. CatskillBrewery.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This week on This American Life. Not long ago, Zach's father called to warn him that the country's power grid was about to be wiped out.
I know, I know it sounds like conspiracy theory, but...
He believes a lot of conspiracy theories. Zach has trouble getting him to see the facts. And then, they figured out a way to settle their arguments once and for all. See eye to eye, have a shared reality. That's this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, increasing clouds and cold with some snow and flurries at times this afternoon. Little or no accumulation, though. High 20, tonight's low 10, and it'll be a little breezy. Tomorrow, cloudy, windy, and cold, still 21 for the high. For the weekend, partly sunny, not as cold. 32 Saturday,